Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are happy to welcome back to the program here Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is the program that we've been doing every month for a long time now on a Monday to give you the chance to call in and ask questions about home maintenance issues. He knows a lot about all the various parts of the single-family house. So if you have questions about attics or basements or gutters or roofing or doors or windows or insulation or anything like that, you call in here and you can talk about it with Scott, and I know he will do his best to help you. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you just start calling and we'll answer as many questions as we can. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Always fun to be here.
One thing that we talked about a little bit last time, I think it probably wouldn't hurt just to mention it again here to remind people that anybody, if you're thinking about doing anything with air conditioning, you're thinking about installing, maybe you don't have it, you're thinking about installing air conditioning, maybe you have an old unit, you're thinking about replacing it, now is the time to be thinking about that and getting lined up with whoever it is that you want to do this work.
Yes, you're correct, because as we get into warmer weather, the heating and cooling guys will get booked up, and then all of a sudden you're going to find out that when you need that air conditioner immediately, that you're going to be on a three-week wait.
So you don't want to wait until, say, July 1st.
Correct.
All right. We have a caller here, someone ready to go, some others coming in, so we'll start in with our first caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling from Champaign, and like so many people in town, I have had to install a sewage lift station in order to pump my wastewater out, and I've had trouble a couple of times with the ejection pump jamming up with things like lint from the washer, dental floss, and other things. Is there any way, besides avoiding putting those things down, the wastewater, to have a pump or have some sort of strainer that would take care of that problem and avoid jamming up? And I'll hang up and listen in for your answer.
Okay. All right. Well, unfortunately, there's no way to put a filter or anything like that on there because of some of the solids that are going through it. Different brands of pumps have different types of cutting blades or effectively, this is almost like a garbage disposal type system where it kind of grinds things up for it, sends it through the pipes. So you might try a different brand of pump. Because most of them work pretty well. I haven't run into too many of them that have had a lot of problems. I do understand that things like string, dental floss, and stuff would be hard on them because it doesn't cut easily and it can wrap around the motor. Usually wash water, lint, doesn't create too much of a problem. But it sounds to me like you might want to change the brand or the style of pump that you've got in the ejection system.
Yeah. You know, just not too long ago, I was talking with somebody who had a problem kind of like this. They were living in a basement apartment, so it was below ground level. So it was, and in the kitchen, they had one of these deals where underneath the sink, there was this pump. And the wastewater from the sink goes down into this thing that's kind of like a big bucket, and the pump sits inside. And the idea is when it fills up, there's a float, and when the float comes up to the right level, it turns the pump on and pumps the stuff out. And it had become gunked up with, you know, grease and waste and nasty stuff over a period of years. And it got to the point where the float wasn't floating. It wasn't coming up so that then it would pump out. And so a plumber came over and he took it apart and cleaned it out, and it was pretty nasty looking. But one of the things that he said was that that particular kind of pump was really not for that use. It should have been a different model or heavier duty thing. So I suppose that's something also to think about. Do you actually have the kind of unit that you really should have for the application that it's being used for?
Yeah, you're referring to one of the standalone units, which are, I believe, they're available at some of the local stores here, where you can actually put it in for like wash water, for gray water. For kitchen water, right. Things like that. Particularly for a bathroom, you need to get a special pump that is designed for have a grind up blade or something to kind of make it a little bit more liquid to get up through there, tear up the toilet paper, things like that.
Yeah. So. All right, let's go to Champaign line two. This is for another caller. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Champaign County, and I was thinking about putting a radon mitigation fan over my sump pump in the basement. And I was wondering, if can I plumb that into the sewer vent to get it through the roof?
Strictly speaking, no. And actually, the fan is required nowadays to be outside of the living area. In other words, you've got to have the fan in the upper area, say up in the attic or something, so that it draws a negative pressure all the way through the living space. You can't just mount it on top of the sump pump. Now, if you run a pipe from the sump pump to the outside, then you can put it outside. But strictly speaking, there should be no pressure on the pipe whatsoever, so you can't mount the pump. Or the fan, and then have that pressurized line run through the house. The fan has to draw up.
You can't put the fan in the basement, huh?
No, you've got to put it above the living space or outside the living space to make it to do it
uh-huh.
correct.
Okay.
Now, I assume you've done some testing and found that you've had some radon.
Yeah, it came back with a 7. I don't remember what the units are, but I think 4 is acceptable, and it was 7.
Did you use a short-term test or a long-term test?
It was 48 hours or something like that.
Okay. First, before I would do anything else, is I would put in a long-term test, because radon is a colorless, odorless, invisible gas which emits out of the ground. It's effectively decomposing rock. It is very much affected by barometric pressure. So while that test is very accurate for your 48 hours, it may not be accurate for the yearly average that the EPA bases their information on.
Oh, okay.
So your best bet before spending a lot of time and effort putting in a mitigation system is to put in a 2 or 3 month test, which will give you a little bit better accurate reading on what the actual yearly average is.
Okay.
So your 48-hour test, if it was a bright sunny day, may have been low, but if it was a stormy day and a low barometric pressure, we could have had more gases coming out of the ground and could have been high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before I would do the long-term test, the first thing I'd do is put some type of sealed cover on the sump pump and see if that does it, whether or not you actually need to put in a fan or not. It kind of depends on how much comes out of it. So if you put a nice plastic cover that's sealed down, it's got some type of gasket or silicone to seal it, and then do your long-term test and see if you actually need to put in the mitigation system.
Okey-doke. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Here's somebody else. Line number 1 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Scott, I'm just curious to know if you've now inherited this program permanently from Hank.
Well, at the moment, it looks that way. Hank's been trying to retire from home inspections for a while, although we keep him busy at the office answering phones and still goes out on inspections with us. We might try and sneak him back in here once in a while, but he's got some projects going out in Colorado, so he tends to do a little bit of traveling.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I had a question about insulation in the attic.
Okay.
And I do have the bats of insulation on the, the floor of the attic, only it isn't a floor. It's just the, not the rafters. What do you call the?
The joists?
The joists. Yeah, in between the joists. And so that's just all I have is whatever that measurement is. It's 8 inches or 10 inches maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think it's advisable to put more insulation over what's there?
Okay, that's a really good question, because as we get a little bit higher energy prices, insulation can be more and more of a return for your money. Back in the 70s, when we had our last energy crunch, we were recommending R19 to about an R24 or something like that. And now with our current weather and our current energy prices, we're recommending an R30 to an R40. If you've got an R19 or a 6-inch bat, it's just about time to add a little bit more. Now, I like to add a little bit of loose fill insulation over the top of the bat insulation. The fiberglass bats do very well at staying in place, particularly out near the eaves and such. But anytime it has to go over an electrical wire or bathroom fan or something, you can get gaps underneath it. Whereas if you add, 3 to 4 inches of loose fill insulation over the top of the fiberglass bats, it fills in the cracks, fills in the air gaps, and it actually makes the bat insulation a little bit more effective. Now, if you've got 8-inch bats, which is R30, then probably no point at this point at right now with energy prices the way they are to add more. The R value on the insulation is an inverse proportion to heat loss. R30 means that 1/30th of the heat that gets to that surface over a given period of time passes through it. The other 29 parts are effectively reflected back towards you, or held from leaving the house. So once you start thinking, okay, well, the difference between a R7 and R14 is 1/14th. You know, the more insulation you add, the less you're actually saving. In order to raise it from an R19 to the R40, or let's say just an R38, by adding 6 inches more insulation, we save 1/19th of the current heat loss.
So it's not very much.
So we're getting a diminishing return as we're getting more and more. Uh-huh. So if you've got R19 or got a 6-inch bat, it's probably not a bad idea to add a little bit more over the top of it. It'll make what's there more effective, plus it'll help bring you up to the R30, R40. But if you've got much more than that, if the R19 was put down over the top of, say, an inch or two of what was originally in the house, if it's an older house, then I probably wouldn't put too much more in, no.
Okay, so if it's 6 inches, I could add a few more inches. If it's 8 inches, you probably don't need to.
At this point in time, if it's 8 inches, you're really probably not going to see a lot of return on the additional insulation.
So I just was watching a program about blowing in insulation, and they use newspapers, treated newspapers, ground up.
That's one.
Is that what you would use?
That's one style. That's a blown-in cellulose insulation,
cellulose,
and it is a paperback or a paper-based product, and it has got a fire retardant chemical. It works well. Most of the installers we've got in this area are using fiberglass, loose fiberglass, and either one of them works quite well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Certainly, other questions are welcome. We have plenty of time here. You have some sort of issue around the house, something that needs to be repaired. You're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling. Scott Spies is the guest. He's home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And we do the show every month and have for a long time to give you the chance to ask these questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And anything else insulation related in terms of general stuff that you might want to?
Well, one of the things that I see when doing inspections, when homeowners are trying to add a little bit more insulation, I don't recommend insulating floors of a crawl space. A lot of people will try and put the fiberglass between the floor joists and in the crawl space. I think it's more effective to put the insulation on the perimeter walls and in the band joist area. The soil underneath the house acts as kind of its own heat source. It stays at about 50 or 55 degrees pretty much year-round. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to insulate the house from that 55-degree heat source when most of your heat is going out through the sidewalls, through your concrete block or through your brick, where it's the outside temperatures are 0 or 30 or whatever it happens to be outside that day. That's where that heat radiates to. So if you put the insulation on the foundation walls and reduce the heat loss out, then that crawl space stays 55 degrees or so. Most of your ductwork on most houses is run through the crawl space, so any heat loss will tend to warm that area. And there again, if we've got the walls insulated, that warm air will rise and come up into the floors. So if you're doing your own insulation, try not to insulate the floor of the crawl space. The other thing to pay attention to is if you're using a faced fiberglass bat, which is the paper-backed fiberglass rolls. The paper backing is effectively a vapor barrier, and a vapor barrier must always be on the warm side of the insulation. So when you're installing it, make sure that vapor barrier is towards the living area. Countless times I've been in a crawl space looking at where somebody's insulated the floors, reading the back of the paper backing on the fiberglass that said apply this side towards living space, which is really well, except that I'm in the crawl space.
And, you know, also one of the things that I'm sure frequently over the years people have asked, they'd said, well, would it pay me to insulate the ceiling in my basement, which effectively then would be the floor of the first floor? And I think generally the answer to that has been no.
That does, it's good for sound deadening, but it's you really want, since the basement is a heated portion of the house, even if you don't have many registers down there, the basement is a heated portion of the house. And usually if you've got the basement, the furnace is located there and the water heater. You want that heat to radiate up into the floors. If you go and put the insulation in the basement floor, then any heat that's in the basement doesn't warm the floors. Since hot air likes to rise, then your floors on your upper level your first floor aren't getting that warm air from the bottom. You're trying to heat it from radiant heat, and it actually makes floors colder to your to the feel when you walk around on them to insulate the from the basement.
Okay. We have some other folks here ready to go. Line one is next. It's someone in Champaign.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a question about roofing. Several years ago, we put rubber roof on. We have two large expanse flat roofs, and they've been very effective, but they're wearing out their guarantee now. And I'd like to know what would you suggest? Is there something improved over the rubber roofing for a flat roof? And can I add a layer of, like, styrofoam insulation on top of that for under the new roofing to be?
Most definitely. The rubber roofing for a flat roof is a very good material. They've made a few improvements on their longevity by changing some of the characteristics of the rubber so that it's a little bit more UV resistant, sunlight resistant. So I would probably stay with the rubber roof, but definitely they do have some insulation boards that you can put underneath it. Usually you have to taper them up a little bit. In other words, make them a little thicker in the middle, taper them to the outside to help reduce ponding so that the water doesn't sit on it. That's the one thing that will reduce the life of the rubber roofing is water sitting in any one particular place. But yeah, definitely they can install either foam boards, tapered thickness so that they slope out, or you could do some of the urethane foam depending on what you're putting it over the top of. They can use the spray-on urethane foam and put the rubber roofing over the top of that.
Well, since there, thank you. Since there are no leaks or anything currently, can we leave the rubber on as is and apply this all over the top of that?
Generally, no. You do not want to put one rubber roof over the top of another.
Even with styrofoam or whatever in between?
No, because rubber acts as too much of a weather or a vapor barrier, and you end up with two vapor barriers, and if you were to get any moisture in between them, the moisture doesn't come out, so you end up with stagnant water, mold and mildew and things like that between them.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the info.
All right.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Next,
we have someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm calling about my crawl space also, but I wanted to know a couple of things. One, someone told me you should cover the crawl wells for the rainy season and then uncover them again. And I have a hill that goes down into my house, so I'm always worried about, you know, runoff getting into the crawl space. So that was one question. And the other is about insects. Living in the crawl space and coming up into the house since I don't have a basement. And I have a particular problem with centipedes almost all year round.
Okay, well, most of the pest controls have companies have a spray that they can go down there and it will take care of most of that.
Mm-hmm.
Usually centipedes and a lot of spiders indicate that we are getting some moisture into that crawl space.
That's what I thought.
How much, of course, we can't tell without actually going down there and looking. Ideally, the grading around the house should be sloped so that the water flows away from the house. We're looking for 6 inches of fall on the first 10 feet from the siding to to the yard.
What about covering the crawl well?
Well, if the crawl space is dry, then we really don't need the vents open, and so, yes, you can cover them. If we do have some moisture in the crawl space, it's a good idea to open them at least in the spring and in the fall. The summertime, you know, you get warm, humid air going into the crawl space and you got your air conditioning ductwork down in the crawl space. We can actually condense water and it drips down onto the vapor barrier. In wintertime, of course, we don't want the cold air going down there freezing our pipes. So crawl space ventilation is best used in spring and fall. If you've got drainage going back towards the house, you may want to consider putting in a drained gravel bed or some type of system to collect that water coming off the yard before it gets to the house and down into the crawl space.
Right.
I'm assuming you've got a good vapor barrier down there now.
A what?
A vapor barrier.
I don't know.
Okay. All crawl spaces, I'm not going to say should, I'm going to say must. All crawl spaces must have a layer of plastic or visqueen down over the top of the soil surface. The way the earth works is that moisture gets in the soil and then the soil wicks it back up so that plants and such can get to the roots and grow. Well, that same moisture is always coming up out of the ground. If you look at a quote-unquote dusty, dry crawl space, I had to prove this to a builder one day. Mm-hmm. I took a 3-foot by 3-foot square piece of plastic and threw it down on this dusty crawl space.
Uh-huh.
And then had a conversation as to how water vapor moves up into the house and moves according to vapor pressure and not airflow. And in the 20-minute spiel that I gave him, we turned around and looked at that 3-foot square piece of plastic, and there's water dripping off of it back into this dusty, dry ground.
Uh-huh.
That's the moisture that's coming up into the house. If you've got a dry crawl space with no vapor barrier, it means that all the moisture in the soil is coming into the house.
Okay.
You can actually evaporate 3 to 5 gallons of water a day out of the crawl space up into the house. So you have to have a vapor barrier, which, and it's just a 4 to 6 mil plastic layer. It doesn't have to be attached or anything. You just lay it down on the ground. You don't want to put any gravel on top of it. You don't want to ballast it or hold it down. You want it to be able to float in case there's ever any flooding.
Okay.
But that vapor barrier is very important to the life of the roof, as a matter of fact. Moisture from the crawl space will actually get up into the attic areas and such.
And the vapor barrier is in the crawl space?
Yes, just laid right down on top of the soil.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is the guest. He's from the Spies Home Inspection Service. And whatever questions you have, you give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455.
I had an interesting one the other day that was a brand new construction, and a client called me up. We had that big swing in temperature, went from 60 degrees one day to 24 degrees the next day, and they called me up and said, all my windows have moisture on them. People don't realize how much moisture is in new construction materials, particularly the houses we're building today with poured concrete foundations. You got to remember, all the concrete on that in the house came off a truck poured. It was wet and has to dry out. You can watch the workmen carry in the buckets of paint, the buckets of drywall mud. Everything goes in wet. So when you have a new house, the first year or two particularly, there's literally tons of water, 2 to 3 tons of water in the house that actually has to dry out. Wow. And we ran into that when we had that big cold snap. A sudden cold snap after we had some warm air.
So a year it could take?
For concrete to cure, yes, it takes at least a year for most of its curing. I'm not sure it ever completely cures if you ever get technical about it, but it cures quickly. For most part, it gets to 80% strength in a fairly short period of time, but the last 20% takes quite a while. So, yes, it takes a full year to dry out a new house.
Mm. So, and other than just making sure that you have some sort of ventilation and so you have air exchange with the outside, that sounds like there's nothing particularly that you can do about that.
Yeah, what I recommend on the new construction when they start seeing some moisture on the windows and such is to turn on a couple of the bathroom vent fans, provided they're vented to the outside, and just draw air through the house.
Yeah.
As we're getting more and more energy efficient, we're also reducing the amount of air exchanges or the airflow through the house. Kind of like breathing into a plastic bag, you notice the condensation will collect on the plastic bag. Well, the way we're building the new construction, putting the actually a plastic vapor barrier on the inside of the wall studs behind the drywall, then we're using more insulation in the walls, a denser insulation, and we put the house wrapper, a foam sheathing on the outside of that. We're actually building the houses more and more like being in a plastic bag, so we have to worry more about what moisture we put into the house.
Okay. Some more callers here. Next is someone in Sydney, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
Morning. Yes, I am. I have a leaky roof on my garage. It's a section that is actually a workshop. It's kind of off the side, and it's got a lesser pitch than the rest of the roof. And I'm going to be fixing it here in May. And I was wondering if the right way to do kind of a low pit, not a very sharp angle, would be to do ice and water first and then architectural shingles, or if there's a better way to do it. That's the way my dad is recommending, and I want to make sure that he's right before I actually do it that way.
Well, that works well as long as you've got some pitch to it.
It does have a little pitch.
Usually with shingles, we try to maintain about a 4:12 pitch or something like that. Once you get much flatter than that, the roll roofing materials or the rubber roofing materials are usually better.
Okay.
If you're really getting borderline on flat, I probably would not use the architectural shingles because they actually have more of a texture and they tend to slow the water flow down the shingles. They slow it down so that the water doesn't run off as quickly. And I've seen an awful lot of them that tend to get a little bit more issues with the ice damming and stuff where water will back up on them because the water is not running off fast enough and it tends to freeze at the edges.
Sure, okay.
So on a low pitch roof, I would not recommend the architectural shingle.
Okay. What? So roll roofing would be better, or
if it's under a 412, then a roll roofing is probably what you want to use. You do want to make sure you use a full double coverage. Usually, the roll roofing comes in a 36-inch wide roll, okay. And like a shingle, you want to have only half of it exposed, so you'll end up with 18-inch exposures. I run into it all the time where everybody's figuring, well, this is 36 inches wide. Let's get a 4-inch overlap at the top. We got 32-inch exposure. But then if you're subject to if there's any hole or any damage, you've only got one layer of roofing there. There really needs to be a full double coverage.
Full double layer, even with the ice and water underneath.
Yes, yeah, even with the ice and water. And I do recommend that, particularly at the edges on a low-pitch roof.
Okay, and to just cover the whole thing in ice and water, that's even better? Is that true?
Depending on how large the area is, that's not a bad idea. Yeah, if you say then that wouldn't be a bad idea.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Let's go to Chicago for another caller here. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. How does one put humidity in an apartment that has radiant heat? Do they make a portable humidifier?
Oh, definitely, yeah. They make several different types of loosely called swamp coolers, which basically have a sponge which rotates through some water and then a fan that blows it through the air through it to help evaporate. And if you've got, particularly in an apartment building where you've got some different styles of heating, either non-forced air units, boilers and radiant heaters and things like that. Yes, it can dry out. A lot of times what will help is to seal the windows so you're not losing the moisture putting in the first place. If you've got leaky windows and such, you can get a lot of airflow through there.
I see.
Normal cooking, cleaning, showering does add some moisture to the house. But if it's still dry, then yes, you can get several different types of humidifiers. And actually, one of the things that I've been seeing lately are these little decorative waterfall units. Trust me, if they're sitting there running, they're putting moisture into the house. And so you could put one, instead of having this big bulky units sitting in the middle of one of the rooms, you put one of these decorative little waterfalls and just add a quart of water to it every couple of days, and it should be fine.
What do they cost and who makes them?
Humidifiers, I'll tell you what, there's such a wide range of different styles. There's no easy way of giving a price range. There's some fairly inexpensive ones, and there's some that are a little more controlled. They turn on and off when the humidity level gets in the house. They're a little bit more expensive. So it's even a vaporizer, a child vaporizer, will work if you've got a short period of dry spell. Usually you don't need to add more moisture unless the temperature really drops below about 30 degrees. If it's over 30 degrees outside, there's usually enough humidity in the air that we've got that we shouldn't need to add too much more. So it's something you want to have that's refillable. You don't want to have to hook it up to a water supply because if you got one that connects up to a water supply, I'm afraid they get set incorrectly and will over-humidify the house. So, the ones you have to keep putting a quart of water in every day or a gallon of water in every couple of days are probably the best.
Do you have to add anything to that, the knockout bacteria or anything?
No, but depending on where you're getting your water supply, you may want to use some distilled water instead of using your tap water because as it does evaporate the water, it will leave whatever minerals or lime and stuff that's in the water, you can actually clog one up.
What should the humidity really be in indoors in the winter, summer? Is there a number?
Well, the summertime, it's going to be fairly high because of our high humidity. Usually, I try and keep it between 45 and 55. In the wintertime, it's going to be hard to get it quite that humid, and you really don't need it because it's relative humidity. It's how much humidity relative to outdoor humidity levels. I like to see it a little bit lower. Now, I try and keep my house a little bit on the dry side because I've got a lot of billiard equipment, pool cues and such that don't like moisture. So I usually try and keep mine closer to the 40-45 range. But for most people, the comfort range is about 45 to 50%.
Is there a gauge that's accurate to measure that?
Good question. Most of them are accurate for a short period of time. In order to measure the humidity in the house, they have to have a couple of plastic strips which are actually exposed to the air. And as they're exposed to the air, they pick up dust. And as they pick up dust and dirt, they get less accurate. I've picked up a couple of small digital ones at a few of the electronic stores in town will carry humidistats that are hygrometers, rather, that digital readout, and they seem to work fairly well for a couple of years.
For a couple of years. All right, then. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue. The next caller here would be in Crete. Line two. Hello.
Yeah, I've noticed some green spotches on my roof where the water runs off. I'm not sure whether they're mold, mildew, or moss. What M word would you give it?
Most likely you're getting just a little bit of an algae growth or a moss growth. Depending on what minerals they used to cover the shingles and how many trees and stuff, how much shading you're getting, some streaking is not all that uncommon. They do make a product called a shingle saver, which is I believe it's a zinc strip that you put across the near the ridge. We have just enough acidity in our rains here in this area that you put that zinc strip up there and the acid rain will wash the zinc down and acts as an algaecide and helps reduce the growth and reduce the streaking.
So there's that shingle saver. I just go up there and with a brush or something, brush it off?
The existing stuff you've got there, you would probably spray it down with even a mild solution of bleach and water. And I mean mild, like a quarter cup to a gallon or something. You don't want to get it such that we get bleach coming out the downspouts and killing all the grass at the bottom of the guttering. But even in a spray bottle, you can kind of spray it and kill off what's there. The shingle saver itself is a metal strip that you would tuck underneath the cap shingles, the ridge shingles.
Very much.
All right. Next to someone in Muhammad, line one. Hello.
Hello, mm-hmm. Steve. Picking up on your last caller, we have extreme mildew on our roof. Hello?
Yeah.
And I've got that zinc sheet across the top, but it doesn't seem to work. And I've tried the bleach. The bleach helped. Some. Is there anything else that can be done about it?
Well, in order for the algae or moss to grow, there has to be a food source, dust, dirt. I'm assuming we're talking about an asphalt shingle roof?
Yes.
Okay. You probably have quite a few trees around the area, so you've got a lot of shade as well.
Yeah. It's on the north side.
Yeah, it's on the north side in a lot of shade. The trees are probably dropping a lot of stuff on the roof that the moss is actually growing on.
This is probably mildew, not algae, unless algae mildew is an algae.
Well, it's a plant growth. Mildew tends to grow a little bit more if there's a constant moisture source. The algae and stuff can go through dry spells a little bit better. They're very similar, and I'm sure I'll get some callers telling me a little bit more about that because that's not necessarily my area of expertise. But usually to control it, any growth on the shingles, keeping it dry or spraying it down with some bleach, something to kill it off, and even just washing rinsing the shingles, usually the trees will reduce the amount of water getting to it or the debris from the trees will fall on the shingles and it's growing on it. Unless it's really bad, it's usually not affecting the life of the shingles. But if it's really bad, then yes, we need to get up there and spray it down. They make some chemicals that can seal into the shingles a little bit better. I believe one of the painting companies was applying it for cedar shingles not too long ago.
Okay. Well, on my problem, I have a 40-gallon gas hot water heater, and it's 35 years old. Is this a threat to... spring a leak?
Depends. Are you in Champaign?
I'm in Muhammad.
Okay, well, now you have a little bit more of a problem. Muhammad water's not quite, although getting better, is not quite as good as what Champaign or Urbana water is. Rather than springing a leak, most of the problems we have around here is the mineral deposits in the bottom of the tank, and the tank doesn't get stay as efficient because we got a sediment build up at the bottom and the water can't move through the sediment as well, and so you end up boiling it. Does the water heater make any thumping or gurgling noises when it's heating it?
On rare occasion, it does.
Okay, because if you're getting some boiling or percolating in the tank, it's time to replace it.
Yeah.
If you've got one in Mahomet that's that old, first of all, I'm pretty impressed. Most of the times, particularly the old water before they got their new saucing system, I'd find them that only lasted 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, glass lining doesn't mean anything, does it?
The glass line doesn't corrode. It doesn't corrode through, but it doesn't help with the deposits, the mineral deposits and stuff in the bottom of the tank.
Okay, and how many years warranty, and what features should I look for in a new one?
They've got several different styles. The ones that have the longest warranty are not necessarily the best, but the ones with the shortest warranty aren't usually recommended either, so somewhere in the middle. The longer warranties, oftentimes what they're figuring on is that, A, you're going to lose the paperwork, and B, that it's a prorated, and if it only makes 5 years on a 7-year warranty or something like that, or 7 years on a 10-year warranty, they're only going to owe you like $60 or $70, and you're probably not going to claim on it.
Hmm.
So, you know, something in the 5 to 7 year range should be fine.
Okay. And installation, is that best done by my own plumber, or can the store do it just as well?
Depending on who you're purchasing it through.
Well, I'm thinking of Lowe's.
Mm-hmm. They do have a list of contractors that you can use. If you've got a plumber that you like, then that's always a good idea. But they've got Lowe's or some of the other, we'll call big box stores today, do have some contractors that they do contract through to do work. And the warranty is usually not necessarily through Lowe's, but through the installer.
Yeah. How efficient is that water on demand system?
The instant hot water systems, they have good points and bad points. I'm not completely sold on them for a house that has two or more people in it, because you're using water enough. The idea of storing hot water is not necessarily a problem. Most of the newer water heaters are fairly efficient at keeping the water warm, so once it's up to temperature, it's not dropping, so we're not using a lot of energy to keep it hot. I've run into several houses that were vacant, nobody's living in it, and the pilot light has been enough to keep the water actually hotter than what the temperature setting is on the water heater. I always try and fire the water heater to make sure it's drafting, and I'll have to run the hot water for 3 to 5 minutes to get enough hot water out of the tank to actually turn it up and get it to fire.
Yeah.
So on that type of a, you know, if you're living in the house on a regular basis, in other words, it's not a summer house, and there's two or more people in the house, unless you've got a situation where the master bathroom is 70 pipe feet away from the main bath for the water heater and you can't get hot water to a system, the on-demands probably are not going to save you enough money to warrant the extra cost.
Okay. And one final question. Brands, are there any that are better than others in your experience?
Water heaters are a lot like furnaces, where there's only a few companies that actually make them, and then everybody else buys them and sticks their label and name brand on them. I really don't have any brand preference, because, to be quite honest, there's about 5 or 6 different brands that I wouldn't be able to tell you who made it, but out of the 5 or 6, probably only 2 different manufacturers were used.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. And I suppose the one thing you would add to that, the caller didn't mention it, but if you have a water heater that's 20, 25 years old, you should get a much greater efficiency in a new one. So as we become more and more concerned about the cost of energy,
yeah,
that's, you know, you're going to end up, in the long run, you should end up saving money on what it costs to operate the water.
Yeah, the newer ones have a little bit more insulation, and they're using a little better technology for heat transfer, the coatings they put on the metal so that the heat transfers to the water faster.
What do you think about the conventional kind that generally drafts up the chimney, as opposed to the newer models that have a powered kind of exhaust, where generally what you do is you run a pipe and it just goes out the side of the house?
One's a little bit more expensive than the other. I think you can find a standard water heater for the $300 range, whereas a power vent water heater is in the $600 to $800 range. There are reasons to use a power vent. If you've got an older house with a brick chimney, as you put in higher efficiency furnaces, we get more condensation of the flue gases inside the brick chimney, and the acidity will then eat the brick. So in that particular case, you put in a new furnace with a direct vent. You'd put in a new water heater with a power vent so you didn't have to use the chimney and you could avoid it. Mm-hmm. New construction, the power vent ones are nice because they don't have to put a chimney all the way from the basement up through two floors and out through the attic. They can just go out through the sidewall. So there are places to put both of them. Most of the time I found that the power vent units are not necessarily to increase efficiency, but more to increase convenience, where you can put it and where you can vent it to.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk with somebody else here in Champaign, line number three. Hello.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bi-level home, and the dimensions are 40 by 24 on the lower level. Two-thirds of the north end has been made into an apartment, and the south end third is a laundry room and an exercise room. Well, as you well know, probably, I'm 4 feet into the ground in the lower level. And what I am concerned now about is insulating at least the apartment end, the north end of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what you recommend. I know in the past that you would construct a wall, but I don't want to lose that much space. I mean, it's only inches, but every inch counts.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you recommend.
Is there a wall finish in that unit at the moment?
No, it's just the cement block wall.
A concrete block wall.
Yes. Yes.
You could go over that with a foam insulation board, which would then adhere to the wall. You probably usually put a furring strip or a wood strip that you can then attach some drywall. Anytime you use a foam insulation in a living space, it has to be covered with a fire-rated material, either a fire-rated paneling or a fire-rated drywall, a Type X gypsum drywall. But to save space, probably your best bet is a foam insulation with some furring strips and then putting drywall over the top of it.
I see. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, our monthly show on home maintenance. If you have a question, something needs to be fixed, you need a little advice, give us a call. Scott will see if he can help you out. 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. That's 800-222-9455. I'm sure we have time for a couple of other callers. Anything else in particular? Just kind
well,
of.
Well, I was hitting on new construction and how much moisture comes out of the house. It brings up another point for those new home buyers or new mm-hmm. homeowners. Because of the construction materials that we are getting these days, we still have a little bit of movement in the house as it dries, as that literally tons of water come out of the house. The house tends to shrink. A lot of people call it settling. It's actually more of a wood shrinkage. You can end up with nail pops and cracks in the doorways. And I had an interesting call the other day where the client was very unhappy with their builder because of all these things that were falling apart. And I had to go in and politely explain to him that it wasn't a poor building job, but merely the movement of the building materials as they dry out, and that they were normal and, generally speaking, taken care of in their one-year warranty. So it's amazing what the moisture will do in the house.
Yeah, all right. We have some other callers coming in here. We see how many we can do in the time that's left. We'll start here with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to put in a little plug for tankless water heaters. I don't know if you were discussing that. I tuned in kind of late. But we have a tankless water heater in our new construction home, and we love it. You never run out of hot water, and you're not constantly heating water, and you don't need it. Fits in our master bedroom closet, so it's a great option for people who might want to save energy on their water heating.
You're right. They do work well, and for some new construction, that's not a bad idea. On a retrofit, I'm not sure that they're quite as efficient. I mean, they're more efficient, but whether or not they save enough to actually pay for the additional costs, because the tankless ones have to have a fairly large burner, and they're usually a little more initial expense. But when you're talking about how much water you're heating, how much energy you're going to save between, you know, if I buy a $400 water heater versus buying a $1,200 water heater.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was a lot more expensive at the front end, but we're hoping to save it eventually. And we just like the idea that we're not constantly heating water that we're not using 24 hours a day. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Okay, well, thanks. And I suppose it also in part has to do, you've got to figure out how much water you use every day. Mm-hmm. And if you have a big family, if a lot of people are taking a lot of showers, if you're doing a lot of laundry, then maybe that's not going to work
for
you.
Right. It is instant. They do put a big burner in there. One of the things we ran into, particularly with some of the construction work that we were playing with out in Colorado, is the water coming out of the ground in Colorado is much colder. And so the instant units have a specific temperature difference. If the water's coming in water comes in at 55 degrees, it'll take it up to 120 degrees, so we can get that 70 degree difference. But if the water comes in at 40 degrees, all of a sudden it's only going to 110. So yeah. In instances like that, they didn't work particularly well. And the new water heaters are efficient enough, as I indicated earlier, that the pilot light can almost keep the thing warm. So it's not like you're losing the heat. Once it heats up the water, it's not like we're losing the heat into the house, or at least not an appreciable amount. So mm-hmm. as we get more insulation and better quality water heaters, the tankless are nice, like I say, for new construction, for like summer homes and stuff like that, where we don't need to keep 40 gallons of water sitting around because we're not using it that often. Mm-hmm. The cost of them at the moment, still being relatively new, is high enough it's going to take many, many years to actually pay for the cost difference.
All right. Let's talk with someone else in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I had my roof replaced recently and in the process had my gutters torn down. And I have an old, like a 90-year-old house that looks much better without the gutters on it. And I know I'm flirting with disaster here, and I understand the basic issues. I'm knowledgeable enough to understand that. It does have a basement, and it's got a large soffit on it. I think there's good drainage all the way around except on one side where I'm considering putting in a French drain. But my question is, when the ground gets saturated like it is now, I mean, how far can you move the water? Does it really matter? You know, when you're living in town like this, everything's flat anyway. I mean, I don't know, just your two cents worth.
Okay. Well, and that can do that. First of all, French drains don't work well in this area, in that if you don't have some place to drain it to a surface drain or a storm sewer, we've got so much clay that we don't have good soil percolation. So to go and dig a hole and put some gravel in it and then run everything to it just does not work well because the hole fills up and pretty soon it doesn't take any more water.
Right. I was going to slope it towards the street. I do have enough, probably just enough slope to get it and enough drop off in the front yard to get it out to the curb, but that's not putting it very far from the house when all the ground's soaked. Does it really matter?
Yeah, and for that, we actually did a system on my father's house, Hank, who used to do the program here, where we put a drained gravel bed. We actually dug a trench right underneath where the drip edge was, put a layer of plastic down in the trench, put in a tile, and then covered everything with gravel so the water running directly off the roof hit the gravel, soaked down into the perforated tile, and then the perforated tile, we then ran downhill, and we effectively
exactly
made an underground gutter.
That's exactly my plan.
Yeah.
Yes, all along the one side of the house that doesn't currently have good drainage, that was what I was considering doing. So that I'm on the right track, you think?
Yep, yep. Okay. What you do is when you dig that trench underneath the drip edge, you then slope the soil back up towards the house, and you lay the plastic all the way from the house down into the trench and then up the outside edge of it, and then set your tile down on top of it and then put your landscaping, usually a gravel or washed river gravel.
Right. So you use plastic and not like a weed cloth?
Correct. You want a vapor barrier. You want plastic.
Okay,
you want something that the water does not soak through.
Okay. All right. So like a really heavy layer or two of this.
Yeah, and anytime you use a plastic that's exposed outdoors, it needs to be a black in color because otherwise it's the sunlight will tear it up pretty quick.
Okay. Well, most of that would be underground anyway, right?
Right. But use like a an 6 or 8 mil
right.
Black plastic, starting at about where the house edge is and working its way downhill to the bottom of the trench and then right. back up the top edge of the trench.
Last question. I know we're out of time. Is there an issue of if I'm not moving it, you know, say I'm not getting active leaking into the basement? A previous owner had done the little trench at the floor on the wall in the basement, so I'm seeing no water on the floor. But is there any risk without these gutters of getting enough more, you know, leaving enough moisture in the ground around the house not to leak in, but to cause freezing and any kind of messing with the foundation on a really old house like this that's been here a long time?
Well, not necessarily freezing, because once you get below 15 or 20 inches, we're not going to actually freeze, so we're not moving anything,
okay.
Which is why we put the footings as low as we do,
right.
so we don't get frost heave. But there's enough clay in the soil that if you saturate it one time, then dry it out, and then saturate it, as clay gets wet, it expands.
Right.
When it dries, it contracts.
Okay.
Well, when it contracts or drops, things can move downward.
Okay.
Particularly the heavy weight of a house.
Okay.
When it goes to expand, it really doesn't have the lifting capacity to move the house back up. It tends to move outward.
Okay.
So we call it a flow. We actually get a slight flow of the soil out from underneath the foundation.
Okay. So am I out of my mind to not have gutters on this house?
Well, no, I won't say that, okay. but I would highly recommend some type of drainage system at the ground level, so that we're, if nothing else, at least 36 inches of plastic from the foundation out, and then a landscaping, so that we're not letting that moisture get into the soil in the first 3 feet around the foundation.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, there, I think we're going to have to leave it for this time around, with the promise that some species or other will be here. We'll be here in a month, and we'll do the show again. Scott Spies is an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do these programs every month, always on a Monday. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and we'll always have a good time. And I want to thank all of our callers for calling in today.